episode, Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington, working on this program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Tuesday, September 6, 2022. Kenyan President-elect William Ruto promises to work with his enemies and friends.
And we are truly, truly grateful. And I want to say to the people of Kenya and to those who have made effort to get us here that we will not let you down.
And a new report accuses the South Sudan People's Defense Force and the SPLM in opposition of committing serious sexual abuses in Unity State.
These violations were committed during clashes between joint government forces and affiliated armed militias or groups on one hand, and elements of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement or army in opposition, loyal to First Vice President Riek Machar on the other.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A new report by the United Nations Mission in South Sudan and the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights say gross violations and abuses were committed in South Sudan's Unity State. ONMI spokesperson says government forces, affiliated militia, and the SPLM in opposition forces loyal to First Vice President Riek Machar committed crimes in several villages of Unity State. Deng Gai Deng has more for VOA from Bor.
The new UN report says more than 170 civilians were killed and more than 30 women and children were abducted between February 11th and May 31st of this year in the three counties of Koch, Ler, and Mayandit, along with neighboring areas in Unity State. And Mrs. Spokesperson Linda Tom says more than 130 cases of rape and gang rape were well documented.
These violations were committed during clashes between joint government forces and affiliated armed militias or groups on one hand, and elements of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement or army in opposition, loyal to First Vice President Riek Machar on the other. The hostilities in Southern Unity State affected at least 28 villages and settlements, with approximately 173 civilians killed, 12 injured, and 37 women and children abducted.
The report says many of the abductees were subjected to sexual violence, including a 90-year-old girl who was allegedly gang-raped to death.
Many of the abductees were subjected to sexual violence, including girls as young as 8 and a 9-year-old girl who was gang-raped to death.
The special representative of the Secretary General and head of the UN mission in South Sudan, Nicholas Asim, said this year's human rights violations were committed with impunity. South Sudan Information Minister and government spokesperson Michael McQuay disputes their findings in the report, calling them, quote, lame accusations.
These are reports which are usually concocted by those who are paid in order to write what others want to be written. If there is anything as such, are they supposed to write to whom? They are supposed to report to the government of South Sudan. A Human Rights Commission is here in South Sudan. All the other, including Ministry of Information, why should they be writing all these? And then you go and pick them from there and you come and ask us about them. Why don't you ask them, did you report this to the government? Anybody who is genuine and doing everything in good faith is supposed to report to the government.
McQuay acknowledges clashes occurred in Unity's Koch, Ler, and Mayandit counties, but asserts that the government intervened and quelled the conflict, which he labeled intercommunal.
Yes, there was a fight, and if there was a fight, that fight has taken place and the government has intervened and it arrested the situation. Now, how can the government be? And you have been following the news, by the way.
Yeah.
Now, how can the government be accused of being a human rights violator at a time when it went there to stop a fighting between communities? And they have managed to do it, and they have collected a lot of arms.
When contacted for comment, Pok Both Baluang, the SPLM IO's Director of Information and Public Relations, said he was on a plane and could not respond to the joint UN report. Several phone calls to Lampol Gabriel, the SPLA IO spokesperson, went unanswered. And Ms. Chief Asam says the government is duty-bound under international law to protect civilians, investigate allegations of human rights violations, and hold suspected perpetrators accountable in compliance with fair trial standards. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng.
Kenyan President-elect William Ruto said he will work to deliver for all Kenyans, speaking after the country's Supreme Court upheld his recent election win. The court unanimously dismissed claims by petitioners, including runner-up and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, that the vote was rigged. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
President-elect William Ruto welcomed Monday's decision, pledging to serve the Kenyan people.
And we are truly, truly grateful. And I want to say to the people of Kenya and to those who have made effort to get us here that we will not let you down. We will work hard and we will not let you down.
The 7-judge court ruled that results of the August 9th presidential election were valid under the Constitution and electoral law. The judges also said they found no significant irregularities or illegalities. Chief Justice Martha Koome read the ruling on behalf of the other 6 judges. She dismissed 8 petitions challenging the outcome, including the one from former Prime Minister Raila Odinga.
The presidential election petition number E005 of 2022, as consolidated with the presidential election petition numbers E01, 2, 3, 4, 7, and 8 of 2022, are hereby dismissed. As a consequence, we declare the election of the first respondent as president-elect to be valid under Article 143 of the Constitution.
The court found that the Electoral Commission deployed technology that correctly identified voters, transmitted results, and was not disrupted. The court also said the polling station results were not tampered with and found that Ruto attained more than 50% of the vote, the standard required for the leading candidate to avoid a runoff. Koome said there were some problems with the election, but none that would call for the election to be invalidated.
Although the petitioners have provided numerous affidavits pointing to possible irregularities and illegalities marked by failure of technology, arranged voter suppression, printing and utilization of Book 2 of 2, EO preparation by the IMBC and its chairperson, commission indiscretions, transposition anomalies, agent absence, and many others, we are of the view that the pointed irregularities and irregularities were not of such magnitude as to affect the final result of the presidential election.
The IEBC is the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. Odinga said in a statement that he will respect the court's ruling. He said, quoting here, "We have always stood for the rule of law and the Constitution. In this regard, we respect the opinion of the court, although we vehemently disagree with their decision today." His running mate, Martha Karua, said on Twitter that the court had spoken, but that she disagreed with the findings. One of the lawyers representing Odinga, James Orengo, also objected to the ruling.
The rule of law should prevail. The court normally has the last word in making a statement as to what is the law of the land. But as citizens who are sovereign, we are entitled to disagree, and disagree very vehemently.
Ruto will be sworn in next week and become the 5th president of the Republic of Kenya, succeeding Uhuru Kenyatta. Muhammad Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Kenya's president-elect William Ruto is facing tough challenge of delivering on his election campaign pledges of creating jobs, employing more people in the public sector, as well as setting funds for various initiatives. According to a political analyst and professor of law at the Nairobi-based Daystar University, Martin Ulo says there are lessons for the region to learn from the way the 2022 Kenyan election was conducted, disputed, and settled.
Generally, the 2022 electoral processes leading to the campaigns and finally culminating into the election day of six different positions, the presidency, the governorship, the senatorial, the women rep, the member of the National Assembly and the member of county assemblies ran generally well. The players were able to campaign peacefully. Voting day was peaceful, albeit with some challenges. But generally, 70 out of 100 in terms of performance, both in terms of what the Independent Electoral and Boundary Commission was able to do, in terms of what political parties were able to do, and in terms of what political players were able to do to sell their agenda and to rally their supporters.
You did mention the process was peaceful and free to a significant extent. What example has the Kenyan election set for the troubled region of East Africa? I'm talking about Uganda, South Sudan, Somalia, and others. And you do work, you do a lot of work on South Sudan, for example. The country has not held any elections since its independence. Ugandan elections are always characterized by violence and intimidation. What example is Kenya setting?
I think when you asked that, I was laughing because I don't think Sudan, South Sudan has held any elections worth talking about. Uganda does not hold elections. That's a one-man show, and what happens in Uganda has nothing to do with democracy. The only comparison we can make in East Africa is really between Kenya and Tanzania. Now, when you compare Kenya and Tanzania, I think that the level of maturity, the level of political competition is civil in Tanzania, is less civil in Kenya, and the outcomes in Tanzania tend to be more acceptable than the outcomes in Kenya because we seem to go to dispute elections every time because the processes and the numbers do not always seem to add up, especially in presidential elections. Not in 2007, not in 2013, not in 2017, and not in 2022. So I don't want to say that Kenya has a very good example on presidential elections around the region. Perhaps compared to Tanzania, Tanzania has done it better, has seen less controversy, and perhaps has seen better legitimacy. Because legitimacy and legality are the issues here. The Kenyan elections tend to be legally correct, but legitimacy is always wanting.
And what do you expect from the incoming Ruto administration? What is he going to do different? And will he have the will and the support necessary to pursue his campaign pledges?
I want to give Ruto credit for being a very hard-working person, for being very committed and convicted to the things he believes in. He's a politician by excellence. If you look at him from the way he thinks, the way he plans, the way he organizes, no doubt about it. But Ruto has also been part of the 2013 to 2017 and now the 2022 government. So if there is anything that has not gone well, he knows it and has been part of it now. How different will it be with him in charge? That is the dollar, the $1 million question. That what is this that he will do that he never was able to do when he was the deputy president and now when he is the president? I think that the jury is out there. He will have to match his eloquence, his oratory, and his great promise with action.
That's political analyst and professor of law, Martin Olo, speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio earlier today from Nairobi. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Britain has a new prime minister. Stay tuned for that story after the break.
Thank you. you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
name something that you haven't tried but hope to someday.
I never drive a car, but I hoped to, because I've grown in a poor background, and in my life, I desire to do so.
I want to travel from Uganda to a different country, because I've never moved out of Uganda, yes.
I've never tried bungee jumping, but I would like to try it one time.
I've not tried paragliding before, but I would like to try it someday, being at the top of the mountain, jumping and flying the sky like a bird.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. On Sunday, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Mike Hammer, arrived in Ethiopia. In a news release, the U.S. State Department said Hammer was planning to meet with politicians and civil society groups to discuss how best to promote efforts towards lasting peace, security, and prosperity for all people in Ethiopia. Henry Wilkins reports from Bahardar.
On Sunday, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Mike Hammer, arrived in Ethiopia. In a news release, the U.S. State Department said Hammer was planning to meet with politicians and civil society groups to discuss how best to promote efforts towards a lasting peace, security, and prosperity for all people in Ethiopia. Hammer last visited Ethiopia and met with officials in July during the ceasefire, which the U.S. government said it found encouraging. However, he was told by Ethiopia's Deputy Prime Minister, Demeke Mekonnen, that the country remains committed to African Union mediation of any peace talks. The visit comes after fighting in the near two-year conflict between the Ethiopian federal government and rebels with the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, resumed August 24th, ending the five-month ceasefire. The US has condemned neighbouring Ethiopia's re-entry into the conflict, an offensive by the TPLF and airstrikes by the Ethiopian government, which hit civilian areas, including a kindergarten. Before the fighting resumed, peace talks looked possible, with the TPLF favouring mediation by the US and Kenya's government, while the Ethiopian government looked to the African Union to broker talks. William Davison is an analyst with the International Crisis Group, a Belgian-based political analysis non-profit. Asked what interest the US has in bringing about peace in Ethiopia, he told VOA.
Above and beyond the desire to bring about peace because of its intrinsic benefits to Ethiopia, because of the devastation that the conflict is causing, the US is of course concerned about the regional and geopolitical implications of increasing instability in Ethiopia, a critical country in the Horn of Africa, which is a important strategic region itself.
Davison says Washington can't force the parties to the negotiating table.
At this point, the US probably doesn't have that much immediate extra leverage to bring to bear. Of course, it has the diplomatic access, and it can implore the parties to recommit to the truce and try and achieve talks. But at the moment, momentum in the US has sort of moved away from any sort of punitive measures. They did establish a sanctions regime.
Among some Ethiopians on social media, there have been accusations the US is biased towards the TPLF. Kiram Tedesi, a pro-government commentator, holds that point of view.
And they even defend the TPLF whenever the joint forces or the combined forces of the federal government and the other allied forces launch their offensive against TPLF. There is a clear dissatisfaction among the social media users.
Ethiopian state and state-controlled media also frequently parrot the view. VOA reached out to the TPLF and Ethiopian government with requests for comment on the arrival of the US envoy. Neither responded. In Tigray, humanitarian organizations say parts of the region are likely in a state of famine due to a lack of humanitarian aid being allowed in. The government has also shut down telecoms and banking there. With clashes looking set to continue, it remains to be seen whether anyone can persuade the sides to open peace talks. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Bahir Dar.
The United Nations is calling for significant and rapid scale-up of humanitarian assistance to revamp a famine in Somalia that could result in a devastating loss of life. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The latest UN Food and Nutritional Analysis released Monday warns more than a million people in the Bay region in south-central Somalia are on the verge of famine. That is the third drought facing Somalia in a decade. UNICEF Somalia representative Wafa Saeed says repercussions from the current drought will be disastrous if international support is not significant and immediate.
And this drought is actually worse than the drought of 2011, where we had 250,000 people lost their life, half of them children. It is worse because it is more in severity, it has lasted longer, and it's impacting larger areas. I've actually spoken to people who are over 70 years of age who told me that they have never seen such a bad drought in their lifetime.
The UN Children's Fund says malnutrition has reached crisis levels. It says 1.5 million children, nearly half of the under five population, are acutely malnourished. It warns some 385,000 children suffering from severe acute malnutrition are at risk of death without special nutritional treatment. Speaking in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, Saeed says some 730 children are reported to have died in food and nutrition centers across the country. She adds the number is probably higher because many deaths go unreported. She says the worsening malnutrition crisis, coupled with a worsening water and sanitation crisis, makes children particularly vulnerable to deadly outbreaks of disease.
We are really very much concerned about this because we are also seeing increase in outbreak of acute water diarrhea. There are more than 8,400 cases this year and around 13,000 cases of measles. And the cases of measles this year alone is more than what has been reported in 2020 and 2021 combined.
Another matter of concern is the large number of children likely to miss an education. UNICEF says more than 3 million children are directly affected by drought, and 900,000, half of them girls, are at risk of dropping out of school. It notes 90% of those who drop out never return to school. The UN Children's Agency says only 65% of its $112 million appeal is funded, and less than a third of the United Nations overall appeal for $1 billion has been received. The agency says donors must step up and respond generously to this overarching emergency to stop the worst from happening. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Liz Truss today became Britain's new Prime Minister. Before being elected to lead the Conservative Party and thus become Prime Minister, she had served as Foreign Secretary and also as the Secretary for Trade. Alex Vaines is the Director of Africa Programme at the British Policy Research Institute, Chatham House. VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson today asked him how Africa might factor into.
My sense is that the UK has, over recent years, rowed back from an uplift, a prioritisation of Africa that they intended to do. But because of the fiscal pressures of the COVID-19 pandemic, the ambition has had to be sharpened and focused. And so last year, there was something called the Integrated Review, which was a vision of British foreign policy that was published. And there we see that basically Britain had decided, or the government had decided, should I say, to focus on East Africa. So there was a pivot of British policy towards East Africa, which meant the East African coast, countries like Kenya and Tanzania, but also the Horn of Africa, so Ethiopia and Sudan in particular. And that's where the UK at the moment stands in terms of its priorities. Liz Truss, who is currently has just taken over as being Prime Minister, but was the Foreign Secretary, has indicated that she will review the Integrated Review. And so my hope is that there will be, therefore, a review on the importance of Africa in British foreign policy.
Now, as Foreign Secretary, Ms. Truss had spoken about strengthening the Commonwealth, of course, that includes a number of African nations, including some that are not former British colonies. Do you see that as being one of her platforms or her goals?
So, Liz Truss has only been to sub-Saharan Africa once in her career, and that was to Kigali, Rwanda, recently for the Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit that occurred in early August. And so, in theory, conservative governments here have talked about the Commonwealth being a priority, particularly after leaving the European Union. Unfortunately, my sense is that there's been a lot of muddling through. And so there isn't really a clear strategy by British government for the Commonwealth currently. I'm hoping that maybe with Liz Truss there's an opportunity to really sharpen that focus and vision. As you say, it's not just a club of countries that were, it's not just a club that are of countries that are former colonies of the United Kingdom. In Kigali, just recently in August, two new members joined, and both have no connections with the former British Empire. So that's Togo and Gabon, both Francophone countries. So the Commonwealth is changing, and there are still a list of countries that want to join. For example, Angola, a former Portuguese colony, has also applied to join the Commonwealth.
Now, my last question for you is the issue of undocumented migration. That has been a growing issue in the UK, in the political structure in the UK. It involves relationships with the European neighbors. Also, there was the policy, which has sort of been put on hold, of deporting undocumented migrants to Rwanda. What's likely to happen there on that issue under Prime Minister Truss?
So in the hustings to be Prime Minister, including the very last one, she continued to defend the contested partnership with Rwanda to repatriate to Kigali informal migrants to the UK. So she has continued to say that this is a good policy, and that she's going to see the end result, which is that informal migrants are deported from the United Kingdom to Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. We'll see. This has been contested by the courts. It's been problematized by the UN. I don't think it's a popular measure, particularly across the United Kingdom. And so maybe this is an area that she'll have to compromise.
That was Alex Vince, who heads the Africa program at Chatham House in London. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson. That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. For world news, go to voanews.com. And if you missed this broadcast, go to voanews.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with Emerson and the song Tutu Party. I'm your host, John Tanzan Washington. Thanks for taking time to be with us this evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Come start a party. We arrive on man arise. Look them sexy lady, look them tasty lady. Them fine, now so they sabi wine. If I watch gonna yai, hey, if only I go fry. I dey watch like a bottom step and die. I see short cut, hey, mini skirt. Who's one for dance with when his party go start?
I want Sale, yeah. I want Bale.
What you want?
Makale. Anybody back me Ale.
Overload.
Not to your business. But in a party you come. Left me make a overload.